First of all, what Suse did, and I'm going to talk to you about the arithmetic in the C1 and C3. I'm going to show you what kind of operations could be performed with these machines. I'm going to show you the structure of the processor, because it's a very interesting point. This was a floating point machine. It was not a machine which was built to do integer arithmetic. It was built to do floating point. I'm going to show you also some highlights of the architecture, some very important ideas that were developed by Konrad Zuse and that were discovered later by other inventors. And I'm going to discuss also the point if the C1 and C3 are universal. By universal, I mean, could they emulate any other computer? If you think of a modern computer and all calculations that this computer can do, we call them the computable functions. The problem is, could these two machines compute all computable functions? Okay, so the C1 was the first machine. It was built between 1936 to 1938 in a period of 2 or 3 years. And the main points about this machine are the following. It was a mechanical design. It was a fully mechanical computer. It was programmable. The program was stored on a punch tape. So it was a binary machine, and you had to punch some holes on a punch tape. And the whole program was stored in binary code in this punch tape. The four basic arithmetic operations were implemented in this machine: addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and also square root, the calculation of the square root of a number. And that's all. That's all the arithmetic that this machine could do. It was completely binary. It was not a decimal machine. If you look at the architecture of the ENIAC, for example, or the architecture of the Mark I built at Harvard, in the forest, these machines were decimal machines. The internal representation of numbers was a mixture of binary coding and decimal coding. But for the memory, the ENIAC and the Mark I, they both use decimal coding. The C1 is a completely binary machine. There is no decimal coding anywhere in the machine. It was also a floating point machine, like I said before. It was not built to do integer arithmetic like the ENIAC or Mark I. It was a machine which could work with exponents and mantissas of numbers. So you could introduce your numbers, input your numbers in scientific notation, so to say, in this machine. The C3 was the model that Zuse decided to build after the C1. It was built between 1938 and 1941. There was a C2, but this was just a prototype, a small prototype, built of a few parts, so it does not count as a complete machine. The next complete machine was the C3, and the C3 is exactly the same as the C1 from the logical point of view. It has exactly the same structure, but the main difference is it was not a mechanical design. It was built with relays, with telephone relays, which were available at the time. It was faster than the C1, but otherwise it was the same machine built with another technology. It was logically equivalent to the C1. So take a look at these years, 1936 to 1938, 1938 to 1941. So these are the years in which Europe was involved in the Second World War. So this work was started before the war, but it was developed during the war. So I wanted just to show you a picture of what was Germany like at the time that Konrad Zuse was developing his machines. This is a picture of 1945, the end of the war, and Zuse got married, actually, in February of 1945. So a baby was coming and they had to get married at the time. So the people were living. They were getting married, they were having children, and they were living in a destroyed city. And Konrad Zuse especially was developing these calculators in this atmosphere. So this is a picture of the original C1. What you see here is the mechanical machine. This is a picture of 1938, and you can see there are many components, many cranks and levers that constitute this machine. You can also see to the left a motor. This motor was used to give power to the movement or to activate the movement of the different components of the machine. And as you can see, it's a very complex device, because you have two problems when building one of these machines. You have to solve the logical problem: how do I build a computer logically? What kind of connections or circuits do I need? And then, when you have solved this problem, you have to solve the mechanical problem: where do I put these circuits? How do I distribute all the logic so that all levers and all rods move in the right direction and they don't get jammed? That was it's the problems in the same machine. This is the reconstruction that was done for the Berlin Museum of Science and Technology in the 80s. So this is not the original C1. The original C1 was destroyed during the war. This is a reconstruction done by Konrad Zuse at that time. And this picture gives you a better idea of the composition of the machine, the kind of structures that you can find. It's like I say always when I talk about this machine that it's like playing three-dimensional chess. You have to solve the logical problem, but you have to have a three-dimensional view of your structures, the structures that you are introducing into the machine. What you can see in the middle to the left is the crank that could be used also to activate the machine. So you could use an electrical motor, but if the motor failed, you can actually turn the crank, give power to the machine, and you could perform your computations. This is the input and output for the C1. What you see to the right, down to the right, is the input device. So you had to pull some levers in this machine, and you could input decimal numbers. I'm going to show you a more detailed picture later on how decimal numbers could be introduced into the machine. And in the middle, it's difficult to see it, but in the middle, that's the output of the machine. So the machine could you could type some numbers into this machine. Then you could let a program run so that you could perform a computation, and the result was shown in the mechanical parts in the middle. Then you had to write down your result, and then you could restart the computer so that it could perform another calculation for you. This is the C3. This is the second model that was built, and this is made of relays, like I said you before. It's made of telephonic relays. What you see to the right is the processor. This is the processor, and there are some registers there, which I'm going to explain later. What you see to the front is the input and output of the machine. It's a kind of keyboard where you could input your decimal numbers with the exponent. And up in this console, you see some lamps which would light and show you the decimal result that you had obtained after your calculation. And back to the left, you see the memory of the machine. This machine could store 64 numbers. That was the whole memory of the machine, 64 words of memory, floating point memory. So you could manipulate in your machine 64 numbers using the registers in the processor. So I'm going to show you now the abstract structure of this machine. So I think most of the people who are here have some kind of experience with computers. Others are not so experienced with computers. If you want to ask a question about these diagrams, please feel free to do it. So what you see here is the block architecture of the machine. First of all, we have the processor to the right. It's a floating point processor. That means that the processor is divided in two parts. There is a part to handle the exponent of the numbers, and there is a part to handle the mantissa of the numbers. That's the decimal expansion of the numbers. The processor is separated from the memory. To the left, we have the binary memory. It's made of 64 words or 64 addresses that you could use to store your numbers. And there's communication between processor and memory. So you could load numbers from the memory into the processor, make some calculations, and then store the result back to the memory. There's a control unit, which is controlling processor and memory, and which has direct communication with the punch tape. And in this punch tape, you have your program. You have the instructions that tell your computer or your machine what kind of calculations, computations you want to do. Each row in this punch tape is one instruction for the machine. For input, you have a numeric keyboard, a decimal keyboard. For output, you have a decimal display. So this is the whole machine, both machines, the C1 and C3. This is the logical structure. And as you can see here, it's a very modern structure. Take the punch tape out of this image, of this picture, and what you essentially have is a von Neumann type of machine, what we now call von Neumann architecture. Well, this is something that in 1936, Konrad Zuse was already using as being a 26-year-old student of engineering. This is the reader for the punch tape. So you can see what SUSE decided to use was film. This film that were used for making movies, 35 millimeter film. That's what he used to put his program on. So you had to punch some holes on this punch tape, and then this reader could read one instruction at a time. And you could do something very important. You could just make end and the end and the beginning of the tape. Put them at the same position, so you could make a loop out of this tape, and your program could then run indefinitely. So you could have a loop running all the time. This is very important, as we will see later, for universal computation. In universal computation, you need loops. You need some kind of iteration. So you could do it with this machine. This is the input output.
How long is the loop length? How long?
That's a mechanical problem. Yeah, I don't know how long were the longest tapes that they use. I don't know, but you can use for the kind of calculations that SUSE used to work out with this machine. It was sufficient. There's a mechanical problem later. That's the kind of problems that the people in Britain had, for example, with the Colossus. The Colossus was an early electronic computer. And they had tapes running for about 200 feet, and that was the maximum that they could manage. 200 feet. That was the maximum that they could manage to put into the machine. Yeah, to run into the machine. So this is the input-output console. As I told you before, there is a keyboard. There is a decimal display, and the keyboard works in the following way. So let's say that you want to input this number, 13,542. Multiply by 10 to the 7. This is your input for some calculation, and this is your keyboard. What you have to do, you have five columns of digits. You have to punch or press the appropriate buttons for your number, like I show you here. So you press 1, 3, 5, 4, and 2. This is the mantissa of the number, the decimal mantissa. Then you have to press the button for the sign of the number. In this case, it's a positive number. And then you have to press the button for the exponent of the number. It's a positive exponent of 7. So you did this in the machine, and then you could start a program. The program could start computing something for you. So please note that the input is decimal input. We have decimal input here, but the machine is a binary machine. So you have to do some kind of transformation before these numbers can be used in the machine. You need a decimal to binary conversion algorithm somewhere in the machine. So this is the internal coding that was used for computations in the C1 and C3, and this is one of the most amazing things for me when you look at the architecture of these machines. The actual coding that SUSE used for his machines is very similar to today's IEEE standard coding that you use in your computers. So if you look at your Mac or IBM PC, almost all of them work now with the IEEE standard coding. With 32 or 64 bits. But what you have there in the IEEE standard is your exponent of your number, your binary exponent, the sign of your number in one bit, if it's plus or minus, the number. And you have the mantissa, the binary mantissa of your number. That's exactly the same coding that SUSE decided to use for the C1 and C3. So he had one bit for the sign, he had 6 bits for the exponent, and 14 bits for the mantissa. In the IEEE standard, you have 1 bit for the sign, 7 bits for the exponent, and 24 bits for the mantissa. So the only difference is the length of the word. It's 32 bits in this standard. It's 21 bits for the C1 and C3. But otherwise, they both use a similar representation. And more important is that the representation is normalized. It's a normalized floating point representation. What do I mean by that? In a normalized floating point representation, you do the following. If you have a binary mantissa, you try always that the leading digit, the leading binary digit, is a 1. So you shift your number, always your mantissa, so that the leading binary digit is a 1. And since the leading digit is always a 1, you don't have to store it. You don't have to put it into the machine. And this is called a normalized floating point notation. The next slide shows you how that works. Assume that you have a number stored in your memory, this number is a positive number because the first bit is a zero. The exponent is the one shown there. It's a binary exponent with 6 bits, and the mantissa is stored using 14 bits. But now when you move this number from the memory to the processor, you have to put the leading digit into the mantissa that was not stored. So you put a 1 in front of your number. So your number is 1 point and then the rest. This leading one is automatically introduced into the number when moving the number from the memory to the processor. And then you also use two additional binary digits at the end of the mantissa. And these are called the rounding digits. This is used to have more accuracy when doing your computations. And this is also what is today used in microprocessors. So if you look at, for example, the book by Hennessy and Patterson on computer architecture, you will find a discussion at the end about why you can do exact floating point arithmetic using only 2 bits for rounding errors and for some computation. And this is what Konrad Zuse was also using in his processor. Okay, you have a problem. There is a problem when you use normalized floating point numbers. And the problem is you cannot represent zero. You cannot represent the number zero. Because if your number always has a leading one on the mantissa, then you cannot write a zero. You cannot write a string of zeros. So you have to need some convention in order to compute with zero. So the convention that Zuse used was the following. The lowest exponent that you could represent with this notation represented zero. So the lowest exponent was minus 64. So any number with exponent minus 64 was a zero. The number with the highest exponent, that was plus 63, that was the number infinite. There was a representation for infinity in this machine. And since you can have plus or minus infinity, then you have 3 kinds of exception. You have an exception for the zero, an exceptional number, so to say, an exceptional number plus infinite, an exceptional number minus infinite. And then if you have this convention, then you have to program your machine, you have to build your machine so that the machine, any time you compute with zero, for example, if you multiply 10 times zero, then you have to raise an exception in the machine and do not compute like you usually do with binary numbers, because you already know 10 multiplied by 0 is 0. So you raise an exception in the machine, and then you give the actual result without having to do the computation. If you find, for example, 1 divided by 0, then the machine also raises an exception and gives you the correct result, which is infinite in the coding being used in this machine. And again, this is the same that is used in the IEEE standard. You have a special coding for zero, you have a special coding for infinite, for minus infinite, and then you can actually let your program run. And even if you have an infinite number, which is rich during the computation, you can let your program go. And then you get the correct result. There are some cases in which you have to stop the machine. If zero by zero is computed, or zero multiplied by infinite, or infinite minus infinite, these are undefined numbers, and then you have to stop the machine. That's what also C1 and C3 were programmed to do. Anytime these exceptions came, the machine stopped, and you could read on a lamp what has happened with your numbers. So numerical exceptions are something that we find today in microprocessors, in modern computers, and they were already there in the C1 and C3. So, okay, I'm not going to show you now the instruction set of the C1 and C3. It's very small. It's really small. It's made of only 9 instructions. You are going to learn how to program this machine with just 2 slides. So there were only 5 arithmetic operations: addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and square root of a number. That's a whole instruction set in this machine for arithmetic. There's anything else. And there are 2 operations to move numbers from the memory to the processor or back. The load instruction, so you can load a number from an address, one of the of these 64 memory addresses, and you can store a number from the processor back into the memory. So these are 2 memory operations. And then you have another 2 operations, which are input-output operations, the 2 at the end of this table. These are the only input-output operations in this machine. And these are actually the most complex operations in the whole machine. Because the first operation, binary to decimal conversion, that's the output operation. That's when you want to see what the machine computed, then you say, I want now the binary to decimal conversion, and you get your decimal result on the display. If you want to input a number, then you have to use the last operation. You input your number on the keyboard, and then you say with the program, I now want the decimal to binary conversion. So on these two operations are much more complex than doing a multiplication, than doing an addition, a binary addition, and anything else. These two are the most complex operations in the whole machine. Okay, this is the whole instruction set of the machine. 5 arithmetic instructions, 2 memory operations, and 2 input-output operations. That's all for these machines. I'm going to show you one simple program for this machine. Let's say that you want to add A plus B multiplied by C. The first thing that you have to do is input your first decimal number. So you read a decimal number and you put it in register 1. I'm going to show you that this machine had 2 registers. This C1 and C3, they had 2 registers. And the first thing to do is to read from the keyboard a decimal number and put it in register 1. Then you read a number again from the keyboard, and then you put it in register 2. This is A and B. These are the numbers A and B. Then you perform the addition. Then you put the result in the memory with the store operation. You store the result in address 10, let's say. Then you get the number C from the keyboard. You read the decimal number C to register 1 in the machine. Then you bring back your previous result from address number 10 to register 2 in the machine. Then you multiply the 2 numbers, the 2 registers, and then you give back the result to the user. You show the result on the decimal display. So this is a program for the C1, C3, and this is the actual assembler coding that you would use to program this machine. And then you would later have to punch your tape. Yes?
Why do you actually need to store the result?
You don't need to. Okay. Okay? You can optimize a lot of things. Okay? But it's just an example of how you could program your computer. Okay. So you all now are now programmers of the C1 and C3. You are familiarized with the coding. And I can show you now how the processor looked like. So this is also a very interesting part of the machine. The processor was made out of 2 registers. So you have 2 registers to hold numbers. Of course, since this is a floating point machine, you need one part of the register, the part on the left, is used to held the exponent. And another part is used to held the mantissa of this number. So the 2 parts together, this is register 1, where you have your floating point, your first floating point number. All the section to the left, that's the exponent part of the processor. This is the mantissa part of the processor to the right. The second register is this one. You have also a part of the register, which is used for the exponent, and a part of the register, which is used for the mantissa. And then you can operate with these two registers. These are all the registers in visible for the programmer. There are no more registers that the programmer can work with. You have only two registers in the processor which you can use for your operations. There are 2 addition units, 2 binary addition units in this machine, 1 for the exponent, so you can add exponents. When you are doing, for example, multiplication, you have to add the exponents of the 2 numbers. And there is an addition unit, or an ALU, for the mantissas. If you are trying to compute the addition of 2 numbers, then you have to add the mantissas, and this is what these 2 adders do. So what you see here is, let me see, no, I haven't, I don't have another one. So let me go back. What you see here is the way that some computations were performed. If you wanted, for example, to add 2 numbers, then you would put the first number in the first register, using an input operation. Then you could put the second number in the second register using also an input operation. And now if you want, for example, to multiply the 2 numbers, then you have to add the exponents on the left, and then you have to perform the multiplication using this part of the machine. So how was multiplication performed? Multiplication was done like at school. It was done using repeated addition of the numbers shifted 1 time to the left. Any time you make another addition, just like you do it with pencil and paper, it was done in this way. So you need a kind of iterative circuit, of recursive circuit, where you add two numbers, then you get the result, and then you can put back the result in any of the two registers R1 and R2. There is an additional register, that's the one in blue that you see to the in the middle. This additional register is not visible for the programmer, but it's used to load temporary results. So anytime you are doing, for example, a multiplication, then you need to store somewhere a temporary result, the actual result of the last addition. You can do it using this blue register. So you actually have three registers in the processor, but the programmer sees only two, and the other one is used internally for the arithmetic. If you want to divide two numbers, then you have to subtract the exponents using the left part of the processor, and then you have to operate on the mantissas, doing repeated subtraction combined with some shifts. So, but the algorithms that were used, and I'm not going to go very in detail into the algorithms, but they are all in my paper, the paper that I gave to you. All the algorithms that were used here are the same algorithms that we use today to do any of these operations: addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and also square root. Okay. So how do you implement such a complex machine? How do you do that everything works smoothly? How can you program the processor so that, for example, in a multiplication, every single step comes in at the right place at the right moment? What SUSE used in order to simplify the machine was to introduce microsequencers. That's what we now call microsequencers. So the idea was the following. There is a conducting rod, this rod in red in the picture, and this rod advances one position per cycle. So this machine is a machine which has a specific cycle. It works with a specific timing. There is a cycle there are 5 cycles per second in this machine. So it's a 5 hertz machine, not a 200 or 300 megahertz machine like today's Pentiums, but a 5 hertz machine, 5 cycles per second. In any single cycle, this rod would move one position, and then you can actually do the following. You can let this rod conduct electricity. This rod is connected to the power source for the relay machine. And then you let some voltage activate some circuits in step one of your operation. Then in the next cycle, the rod moves one step, and then you activate other circuits in the machine. Then in step three, the rod moves one step, one additional step, then you activate other circuits, and so on. So you see, it's now very easy to implement the processor, because you only need a basic set of operations, like addition of two numbers. And then by combining repeated additions, you can do, for example, multiplication. So you need one of these microsequencers for multiplication. If you make an error, your machine is not going to run, but it's very easy to change the order in which you are combining your operations. It's very easy to modify what you are doing. So the way SUSE implemented this was to use one microsequencer for each arithmetic operations. Of the arithmetic operations. And what you see here are the microsequencers in the actual machine. These microsequencers, this is seen from the side, these are rotary dials for telephone systems. So these are actually the parts that were used for telephone systems. And the moving bar is not very visible here, but you can see the whole that there are many cables. These cables are activated and they receive some voltage in every step, and they activate all the circuits of the machine. And this way you can minimize the hardware that you need for your processor, because you can reuse your processor. You use it recursively for the different arithmetical operations. Okay, so I told you I was going to give you some or talk about some highlights of this machine, some concepts that were introduced later into modern computing, but which were already there in these two computers. I already gave a hint. Von Neumann architecture was actually there in these machines. Floating point coding, like we use today, was there. And there are two other important aspects of this machine. One of them is pipelining, what we now call pipelining. Pipelining means when you have a program, then you can actually overlap the instructions that you are executing. so that your processor starts doing something with one instruction and at the same time he's doing another thing with another instruction. So you overlap operations. In the C1 and C3, you could also overlap instructions. So instructions were overlapped all the time. And the way to do that was to divide the instruction in an executable part. Anytime you did something, then you would compute an arithmetic operation or something in the processor, and then you had to store your number in the memory or in one of the registers. The store operation was overlapped with the execution of the next instruction. So this was a pipeline with two stages, like we would say today. Of course, modern microprocessors have pipelines with 5, 7, or even 10 stages, but this is the first pipeline that you can find in computer history. A pipeline with two stations where execution and the write back to memory or to the registers is overlapped with the next instruction. So in this way, store operations actually run in zero cycles. So anytime you store something to memory, it didn't need any additional time. So there's another aspect of these machines, which is also very, very interesting. And this is the fact that both of them use carry look ahead. So carry look ahead means when you are adding, for example, decimal numbers and you have 9 plus 1 at one position, at one column, then you have to give a carry to the next column. And if you are you have 99999 plus 1, for example, then you have to give a lot of carries to the left every time you are adding. So you only have a single one which you are adding, but you get a lot of carries. So this is you have the same problem in binary. If you have a 32-bit binary number and you add these two numbers using a very simple circuit, then you have to wait 32 steps until you get the correct result, until all carries propagate. So SUSE used another technique which is used today in modern microprocessors. It's called carry look ahead. Carry look ahead means the following. You compute, first of all, the sum of the two numbers without carries using an XOR operation for binary numbers. In the next step, you compute all propagated carries, so the right position for all carries in a single step. And in the third step, you produce the final result by combining carries with the first addition. So this means that using relays, that's what SUSE had in his machine, you can perform addition in just three steps, regardless of the number of bits. So you can add 1 trillion bits, two trillion bits numbers using relays, and then you do it in just three steps. This is not the same for VLSI, for example, for transistors. Transistors have a delay time. And if you add 2 trillion bit numbers using transistors, you have a time that's a function of the length of your binary numbers. That's not the same for relays, because relays, they all fall at the same time and there is no delay in the circuit. So actually, if you are adding 2 trillion bits numbers, it's more efficient to do it with relays than with VLSI. Okay, but this is something that was rediscovered later. It was known by Babbage, for example, in the 19th century, but nobody knew about the work made by Babbage. It was rediscovered later and was introduced in almost all machines, this kind of operation. And we use it today, carry look ahead. But it was there right from the beginning. Shifting is also one operation which, using VLSI, can be done at the best in logarithmic time. That means if you have, for example, 1,000 bits and you want to shift these bits to any position, to any of one in 1,000 positions, then you need at least logarithmic time using transistors. So in case of 1,000 bits, you need something like 10 steps. With relays, you can shift numbers in constant time, in a single step. Because all relays, they all fall at the same time, and your shifting tree, so the people who are familiarized with the way this is done, your shifting tree gets loaded in one step, gets positioned in one step, and then you can do the shifting in just one operation. And this kind of shifting tree was included also in both machines, in the C1 and C3. Well, and now we have a Java simulation of the C3. Which is available on the internet. I'm going to show it at the end of this talk. I just want to show you this slide because many people say if you put the word first at the beginning and the word computer at the end and then you add enough adjectives, then you can make almost any computer, the best computer in the world. Okay, so that's why, for example, if you look at the literature on the ENIAC, they never say the ENIAC was the first computer in the world. They always say it was the first large-scale electronic programmable computer in the world. Or if you look at the machine built by Jonathan Azoff, they always say it was the first electronic computer, and so on. So I decided to put my own adjectives here, and I'll show you later the simulation. It was done 2 years ago by a student, one of my students, who wrote it as his thesis, and it was, I think, one of the first Java programs that were actually running on the internet. So I'm going to show you now something that's very interesting. And the problem is the following. I told you at the beginning, you have the logic, and then you decide to build a binary machine. But if you are using mechanics, if you are using mechanical components, how do you implement logical operations using mechanical components? How do you solve that problem? I'm going to show you three circuits. So this is a mechanical relay, like Suse called it. It's actually a conjunction. If you have three bits or two bits, A and C, and you want to compute A and C, and the result is B, then you can do the following. You use three metal plates for each bit. The first plate on the top, it's used for C. It's called the control bit in this circuit. The bit A is represented by the plate in the middle, and bit B is represented by the green plate. So you see, we want to put two numbers or two digits in these first two bits, and then we want to put the result on B. So how can this be done? So the coding used by Suse was the following. If the plate is not moving, it's a zero. If the plate moves, it's a one. So bit A is changing from not moving to moving. So it's moving to the second position, and this is a one. Okay? So this is very easy. So now control bit C is at the zero position. So if control bit C is at this position, there is no connection. There is no mechanical linkage between bit A and bit B. So when bit A moves, bit B does not move. So it doesn't matter what A is, the result is always zero, because bit C is always zero, like in a conjunction. So let's change bit C. So let's change now bit C from the zero position to the one position. So bit C is now a one. And now now you have a mechanical connection between bit A and bit B. And when I put a 1 in bit A, now bit B becomes also a 1, as you can see. So this is the mechanical circuit for conjunction. You have three bits, two bits on the top, the two bits that you are combining, and you have your result here. So you have a movement, and this is a 1. Okay, another circuit. A two-bit multiplexer. Multiplexers are used in modern computers for many things. You have to select from many bits which of these bits you want to give off to another bit. And in this case, we have just two bits, bit A and bit B, and we want to select which one of these bits are we going to put into bit C. So in this case, if we have the control rod in this position, there is a mechanical connection between bit A and bit C. When we move A, then bit C becomes equal to A. So if bit A is in this position, bit C is in the zero position. If bit A goes to the one position, bit C goes to the one position. So we are selecting from the two bits, we are selecting bit A. So now you can guess how to select the other bit. We just move the control rod. This is also a bit, so we can change the value of this bit by moving it. Then now there is mechanical connection between bit B and bit C. And when we move B, then we get the result copied to bit C. So this is a two-bit multiplexer, and of course you can combine many two-bit multiplexers to do any kind of N-to-M bit multiplexers. So now the mechanical memory. How were bits stored in the machine? So what you see on the top is the three-dimensional view of how one bit was stored. One bit, each bit was stored according to the position of the green rod that you see there. So what we now have here, so this is a three-dimensional view, and but viewing from the top, so seeing this arrangement from the top, you see the rod here, and we call this the zero position. So this is a rod which is storing one bit, one zero. And now assume that we want to store a one. We want to change from zero to one. So there is a control rod, this black rod, prepares the operation. So that means that this control route changes from 0 to 1. Then the other route puts the right bit into the, or moves to the route to the right position for the one that we want to store. And now the control route just moves and stores the number. So, and you can, of course, invert the operation and move from 1 to 0. So this is the mechanical storage of the machine. This is a one-bit memory for the machine. And then you can, of course, arrange many of them. And then you need some kind of decoding in order to get the right bits for your computation. But this is just, well, it's a mechanical and a logical problem. Okay, I'm going to show you a short video of the C4. This is not the C3, this is the C4. It was built from 41 to 45, right at the end of the war, and it has to be moved from Berlin, which was being taken over by the Russian army, to Bavaria, where I think this film was made. So this is, it's being loaded now. This is Konrad Zuse, checking one tape for the C4. The C4 is a much larger machine, as you can see. It has more memory. It had 1,000 words of memory. And remember, this is 1945. It's 1945. 1,000 words of memory, floating point. The program could be stored in this tape. And you're going to see right now, this is a film tape, a plastic tape, like the one. And this is actually one which has been used, so you could have your favorite picture and your favorite program on the same tape, favorite movie. Okay, so I think this is the end of the video. And it's very interesting because it shows you how these machines actually look like. And one important point about this C4, this machine, is it was moved from Berlin after the end of the war to Bavaria. And in 1949, it was installed at the university in Zurich, at the ETH in Zurich. And this was the first commercial machine in the world. Because, again, if you read many books about computer architecture or computer history, you will find that the UNIVAC 1 was the first commercial computer of the world. It was delivered in 1951. Well, this one was delivered in 1949 to the University of Zurich. Okay, my last question, and now and then we can go for some questions from you, and I can show you the Java simulation of the machine. The question is, were the C1 and C3 universal? Are these computers, or are they calculators? So you saw that you can only compute the four basic arithmetical operations, and then you can go in a loop using this operation. But is this enough for a computer? Can you do any calculation you want to do using this instruction set? That's the theoretical problem. And this problem was open, so it had not been solved, and I solved it just last year, and I published the result in this year's IEEE Annals for the History of Computing. The answer is yes. You can do any computation you want by using a single loop and by using arithmetical operations. Actually, you even don't need division. You can do well with addition, subtraction, and multiplication. That's all you need for universal computation. And an infinite loop, which is being repeated all the time. So that's what you need. You need a single arithmetical loop, which is repeating the program. And then you need these arithmetic operations. And of course, you need also load and store. You need to move numbers from the processor to the memory and back again to the processor. So this is all you need for a universal machine. But there is still a problem, which is important here. If you have a single loop of arithmetical operations, and the loop is going and going and going and going on, how do you stop the machine? When does it stop? So you have to stop somehow this machine so that you know the computation is ready, it has been done. So you can do it using exceptions. You arrange your program so that it computes and computes, and when you are finished, you compute 0 divided by 0. And when this computation is done, the machine stops and says, this is an illegal operation, I'm finished. So this is the way to stop this infinite loop. Otherwise, you cannot stop an infinite loop made of only arithmetic operations because there is no conditional branching. Okay, so this is also an interesting thing. If you look at many books, they always say, for universal computation, you always need conditional branching. You need some kind of decision of how you are going to continue with your computation. Well, you don't need conditional branching for universal computation. You can simulate conditional branching using these instructions. And the details are at the end of my paper. That's the last section of my paper where I tell you how to do universal computation, how to simulate branching using these instructions. Okay, so this paper is, like I said before, in the IEEE Annals of the History of Computing. And there's more information in my homepage. You can look at my homepage at the University of Berlin. And there are some papers about these machines. And I edited a book at the beginning of this year. It was published by Springer Verlag in January of this year. It's called, it's in German. But all the information is there. So, and that's what we actually did. And I want to show you, just to end my talk, I want to show you the simulation. I want to show you the simulation of the C-tree. It's available on the internet. Now it's being loaded from my drive. And if you look at our homepage, then you will find what's going to be shown now. I'm sorry, it's in German. So, but you don't need to understand German to see the simulation. So you just click on this button, and then you get this window. And what you see here is the actual architecture of the machine. So what you see on the top is the punch tape. What you see on the left is the exponent part of the machine, the mantissa part of the machine. The input, the keyboard, is on the top to the left, and the output is down to the left. You can see how this machine is working. Now it's running. It's already running because this machine was always running. This machine is always adding the contents of the two registers, regardless of if you are computing something or not. The machine is always running. It's just going doing the same operation. This is one cycle of the machine. So if you want, for example, now to add, let's make something very simple, 2 + 2, then you have to input a 2 by pressing on the button, as I did. Then you have to start the decimal to binary conversion, and now you see that many things are happening. Information is being moved from one register to the other. This is the decimal to binary conversion algorithm. This is what I told you before. These are the most complex operations in the machine. So now the result is stored in the green register. You have exponent 1, binary exponent 1, 2 to the 1, and mantissa 1. So this is a 2. Okay. I'm going to read it again. And when I read two numbers, one after the other, then the second number is going to be stored in the second register, in the lila register that you are seeing in the middle. So now the decimal to binary conversion is again going on. And now we have the result. So now we have a 2 in the first register, a 2 in the second register. And now I can tell the machine to do an addition. So now the addition of the two numbers is being performed, and the result is going to be stored in the top register. Now it's finished. Exponent is 2, mantissa is 1, this is 2 to the 2, 4. Now I can show you the result. So now the binary to decimal conversion is being performed, and we are going to see the result to the left, down to the left on the lamps. So one of the lamps, I think you cannot read it, but it says it's a 4. Because the 4 on the in one of these columns is lighted, and the zeros are also. So it's 4.000. Okay, that's it. If you want to play with this simulation, it's on the internet. The interesting point also of the simulation is it's not just a simulation of the user interface. The circuits and algorithms of the C-tree are running on the back. So you are playing with the original machine in an emulation. Okay, thank you. And if you have questions, please. Any questions? Yes? Yes?
It proved that German Gatmann wouldn't support SUSE and his machine?
Yeah, that's almost true. Yeah, almost true. SUSE worked for the Air Force. So he was called to serve for the military, and he was sent to do some work for the Air Force. So his work, in some sense, received some help from the people who knew about it. But essentially, the German government was not aware of these developments. So nobody in the military, nobody in who had the power to take some decisions understood what he was doing. So he received some money and some help, but not a lot of help and not a lot of money. So you can say that essentially he did not receive anything comparable to the amounts of money that were used in the USA for the ENIAC or the Mark I, for example. Yes?
Was there any communication at all between Tanasov and Zuse?
No. Zuse didn't know about Atanasov, he didn't know about the ENIAC, and he didn't know about the Mark I. The first time he knew about developments in the USA was at the end of the war, after the war. And of course, American inventors didn't know about Zuse. All of these people met after the war. Zuse went to visit the ENIAC team and the Mark I team in 1948 or 1949, something like that. Yes?
Did he get any inspiration from Blazer Chen?
The inspiration? No. He didn't know anything about computers. That's the interesting part. Excuse me? Yeah, but it was a decimal computer. And that was the way mechanical computers were made in those years. If you wanted to build a mechanical computer in the 30s, everybody would tell you you have to use some kind of rotational device. Because it's very easy. If you have a rotational device, then you can put 10 digits on this device, and the position gives you the number. That's what the Mark I people, for example, at Harvard did. They use a rotational device, and this is the way all mechanical calculators work. So it was a kind of crazy thing to build a binary mechanical machine. It was crazy from the viewpoint of mechanics, but it was of course right from the viewpoint of the logic. Yes.
It appears as though it's an infinite word on each spot on the strip.
You mean to the left or where? The tape. Yes. The coding is an 8-bit coding. Yeah. For the instructions. Excuse me?
Why was it 8-bit?
Because you needed 2 bits for the operation and 6 bits for the address. The machine had only 64 addresses of memory, so this was the way the coding was organized. Okay, I think the next speaker wants to start, so thank you very much. And if you want to get more details, look at my homepage.